Hi, this is Terry Kuzma from Penn State University. I'd like to introduce Dave Johnson, and what Dave's going to do today is cover dielectrics by growth and deposition.
Here's our outline for today. The oxidation of silicon to create the dielectric silicon dioxide takes place at very high temperatures, typically between 800 and 1200 degrees C in a furnace at atmospheric pressure. The oxidation of silicon is performed using oxygen or steam, and we'll discuss the difference between those shortly. Silicon dioxide is a form of glass and has many qualities that make it a versatile material. It does form naturally on silicon, but when this happens, the quality is very poor and it's generally considered to be a contaminant. Silicon dioxide is an insulator or a dielectric material and has a tetrahedral atomic structure. Silicon dioxide can be crystalline, like quartz, or it can be an amorphous material, like fused quartz. And when we're talking about silicon dioxide as it appears on the surface of a silicon wafer, we're mainly concerned with what the material properties are like beyond the interface of the silicon and silicon dioxide. So generally speaking, silicon dioxide in the oxidated state on a silicon wafer is an amorphous material. A 1-unit cell of silicon dioxide is a tetrahedral where each silicon atom bonds to 4 oxygen atoms, regardless of the silicon dioxide being crystalline or amorphous. The quality of an oxide layer is determined by these parameters. And a high-quality oxide is very uniform, has no defects like pits or holes in the surface, has a very high dielectric strength, and low stress on the silicon-silicon dioxide interface. The thickness of silicon dioxide grown from a silicon surface will have different colors at different thicknesses. A trained eye can approximate the oxide thickness based on the color that it appears. And here is a silicon dioxide color thickness chart. You can see that this method of determining oxide thickness can be quite subjective, but it's useful in conjunction with oxide measurement systems like ellipsometers to help you limit the potential options. So you can see here there's a big difference between thicknesses on royal blue or blue to blue-green, which may potentially have a similar appearance in color. But with the expected thicknesses here, there's a large difference. So when you're using this chart to help determine an oxide thickness, having some experience in knowing what these colors are like can give you a good idea as to what the potential thickness of the material is. So next we're going to discuss the mechanism of silicon oxidation. Initially, the diffusion of oxygen to the silicon surface occurs very quickly because there's no oxide on the surface of the sample to prevent the diffusion of the oxygen to the silicon. However, when the silicon dioxide starts to grow, there's a very short duration in which the growth is linear, and this is considered to be reaction rate limited because the diffusion of the oxygen to the silicon surface happens very quickly. But after the first 15 nanometers or 150 angstroms of oxide growth, the oxygen has to diffuse through the grown oxide layer to the surface of the silicon-silicon dioxide interface. And the growth that occurs after the first 150 angstroms or 15 nanometers is considered to be diffusion limited instead of reaction limited, and the rate at which the oxygen will diffuse through the oxide layer is governed by Fick's law of diffusion and is determined by the temperature of the oxidation furnace and the concentration of gas inside the furnace. So here's a schematic of oxygen gas diffusing to the sample's interface of silicon and silicon dioxide. So this interface is right here. And the ability for this oxygen to diffuse through the silicon dioxide is going to be determined by the concentration of oxygen and the amount of heat inside the system. As this oxide layer continues to grow from the surface, it'll take more energy for that oxygen to be able to diffuse through a thicker oxide layer, and the growth rate is no longer linear. Oxidation is considered to be a growth process because part of the silicon substrate is consumed. When an oxide is deposited, the silicon comes from an outside source, like silane-containing gas. So in growth mechanisms, oxide is created through the consumption of silicon on the surface. In deposition processes, the silicon comes from an outside source gas, is reacted with oxygen in a reaction chamber, and silicon dioxide deposits on top of the surface of the sample. So typically, for every 1,000 angstroms of oxide thermally grown, 400 angstroms of silicon is consumed. So next we're going to look at different uses of silicon dioxide. A native oxide will grow on a bare silicon surface from oxygen in the air. This material typically won't grow any thicker than about 4 nanometers because oxygen can't diffuse through the oxide layer to the silicon-silicon dioxide interface at room temperatures. A gate oxide, on the other hand, is a very high-quality oxide that is typically grown using a dry oxidation method and are used as dielectrics on high-performance electronics. The dry oxidation growth process is going to be discussed a little later in this presentation, but the ideal thickness for a gate oxide is determined by the dimensions of the device, and generally speaking, as a dielectric component gets smaller, a thinner gate oxide can be used, which will improve the performance of the device. Here's a side profile of a few different substrates where native oxide is being shown on the surface of a sample and where a gate oxide might be found on a sample. Field oxides are used to separate device components and tend to be very thick. These oxides are grown in a wet oxidation process, which will be described in a little later in this presentation. Since this oxide is used to separate device components and tends to be very thick, the quality isn't very important. A barrier oxide is used to protect devices that are already created on a substrate from subsequent processing. And since these device components typically have metal involved in their inner workings, the oxidation process tends to be at a very high temperature, and the high temperature process can degrade those existing metal features. So barrier oxides tend to be deposited instead of thermally grown. And here's a side view of a sample showing where a field oxide and a barrier oxide might be used. So similar to barrier oxides, dopant barrier oxides can allow for selective deposition, etching, or doping of a specific area of a sample while protecting the rest of the sample during a fabrication step. The oxide thickness for the dopant barrier will be determined by the application. Silicon nitride films will typically experience some kind of a stress when deposited onto a silicon substrate, and a pad oxide can provide a barrier between the silicon and the silicon nitride, preventing the silicon nitride film from experiencing a large amount of stress. So here's a schematic showing how a dopant barrier oxide and a pad oxide may be used. So implant screen oxides are similar to dopant barrier oxides, but this term is reserved for an oxide that will protect a sample during ion implantation. These oxides can be grown or deposited depending on any temperature limitations the sample may have. And the thickness of these oxides is going to be determined by the implant depth of the dopant. Insulating barrier oxides are going to separate metal layers and are typically deposited to protect existing metal features from high temperatures in the growth in the oxide growth process. So here are some pictures that show how these two oxides can be used. So now that oxides and their uses have been covered, let's see how some of them can be grown. So again, a growth process is a high temperature process where the silicon substrate is converted to silicon dioxide in either the presence of pure oxygen in a dry process or in the presence of hydrogen and oxygen in a wet process. On the other hand, deposition is a low temperature process where silicon containing gas and oxygen containing gas react to form silicon dioxide. So one way of thinking about this, again, is the growth process consumes a silicon from the silicon surface, where deposition consumes silicon from a gas phase reactant. In furnace oxidation, these parameters are always tightly controlled. So dry oxidation is the slowest form of furnace oxidation and is used to create higher quality oxide layers. Dry oxidation typically occurs around 1,000 degrees C or higher, and this temperature is chosen to reduce the stress at the silicon-silicon dioxide interface. During oxidation, unbonded silicon atoms from the crystal surface of the silicon substrate can leave a negative charge at the silicon-silicon dioxide interface. This charge buildup is called a fixed oxide charge. This fixed oxide charge can be removed when a chlorine-containing solvent or gas is introduced during the oxidation process. Reducing this fixed oxide charge will alleviate film stress at the silicon-silicon dioxide interface. So here is a typical dry oxidation recipe. The furnace will typically stay at an idle temperature close to 800 to 850 degrees C and is going to be purged with nitrogen to keep an inert environment inside the furnace reaction chamber. Samples are typically slowly inched into the furnace, and once the samples are totally loaded into the furnace, the temperature of the furnace will be slowly ramped to 1,000 degrees C. Once that temperature stabilizes, the reaction gases are inputted into the chamber until the desired oxide thickness is reached. Then the temperature is slowly ramped down inside the furnace to an unloading temperature, again around 850 degrees C. And the samples are slowly retrieved out of the furnace. And the sample loading and temperature ramping are done slowly to ensure that the samples are not damaged by sudden temperature changes. So here's a graph of the growth rate of dry oxide at 1,000 degrees C. And there's only one short step where growth is linear, and that's within the first 150 angstroms or 15 nanometers. And after that, the oxygen has to diffuse through the grown oxide layer, which means the rest of the growth process is non-linear. And the growth rate is going to be determined by the ability of the gas to diffuse through that oxide layer, which is going to be, again, governed by temperature and the concentration of gas inside the furnace. Wet oxidation occurs by adding hydrogen and oxygen to create steam inside the furnace. The oxidation process is considerably faster in wet oxidation than in dry oxidation, but produces a less dense oxide, which means the quality of the oxide is highly diminished. We had mentioned during the discussion of dry oxidation that chlorinated solvents can reduce the fixed oxide charge at the silicon-silicon dioxide interface. And low concentration of chlorinated agents also immobilize metallic ion contaminants like sodium, potassium, and lithium. And the chlorinated organics like trichloroethane or dichloroethane are typically used at very low concentrations to help prevent corrosion of the furnace equipment. So here's a growth rate chart for the wet oxidation at various temperatures. Generally speaking, growth rate is faster at higher temperatures because the gas can diffuse to the silicon-silicon dioxide interface quicker at higher temperatures. The steam produced in wet oxidation can leave trapped hydrogen in the silicon dioxide layer that grows, and this will alter the stoichiometry and change the density of the oxide, resulting in a lower quality oxide when compared to dry oxidation. Steam can saturate an existing oxide layer better than pure oxygen gas can, and this will allow for oxidation, for faster oxidation through improved gas diffusion to the silicon-silicon dioxide interface. So here is a comparison chart of dry oxidation and wet oxidation and the amount of time that it takes to produce a 100 nanometer oxide at 1000 degrees C. And this is a considerable time difference between these two processes. And here's a chart showing both dry and wet oxidations times and the approximate thickness. On the x-axis, there's the oxidation time in hours. On the y-axis is the expected oxide thickness in microns. And you can see by the scaling of the x and y-axis that growth is nonlinear. When the oxidation temperature is increased, the oxidation time to reach a desired thickness decreases. There are significant problems that can arise when this is done. Ionic contaminants can mobilize at higher temperatures, things like sodium, lithium, potassium, and if they end up in a dielectric material, they can change the dielectric properties of that material. Crystal defects can occur at the silicon-silicon dioxide interface, which can lead to small amounts of crystalline material in the general amorphous structure of the remaining portions of the oxide. And the sample can become permanently warped due to thermal stress when oxidizing at very high temperatures. So let's talk about some ways that we can improve upon the oxidation process and eliminate some of those drawbacks we just discussed through the use of high pressure oxidation. High pressure oxidation, or HYPOX, is a way to overcome these problems that were just described and produce high quality oxides under relatively short oxidation conditions. So here's a schematic of a high pressure oxidation system. The furnace tube is going to be a quartz material, and there's going to be ballasts on the ends of the reaction tube in order to increase the pressure inside the system. And these are generally encapsulated in some type of implosion shield. So if something goes wrong with the quartz tube and the system breaks under high pressure, glass does not project towards a user or outside into the room where the oxidation process is taking place. So these systems will typically operate at reduced temperatures and very high pressures. Typically in nanofabrication, we're talking about pressures that occur in the vacuum region. Here, when we're talking about high pressure applications, we're talking about things being between 5 and 20 atmosphere. And to keep this into perspective for you, atmospheric pressure is 760 torr, or 1 atmosphere. So in this chart, you can see how increasing the pressure of the system while holding temperature constant can decrease the oxidation time. Increasing the pressure of the system allows for a 30 degree C drop for every 1 atmosphere of pressure increase. The benefit in oxidizing at lower temperatures is an increase in the density of the oxide film. So increasing the density means that you can increase the quality of the oxide. So next we'll talk shortly about chemical vapor deposition for oxidation. And Deposition requires an external silicon gas source and does not consume part of the substrate during the deposition process. Typically, in chemical vapor deposition, silane is going to be reacted with oxygen to create silicon dioxide in a plasma state that is then deposited to the silicon surface. And these are very low temperature processes that will take place. And in particular, when we're talking about plasmas in 350 degrees C inside a CVD system, we're talking about plasma-enhanced chemical vapor deposition. These deposition processes are used typically whenever there's a temperature-limited material on the surface of the sample. So if a process had been performed to deposit aluminum on a surface and that aluminum needs to be encapsulated with an oxide material, entering that sample into an oxidation furnace that might operate at 1,000 degrees C will cause the aluminum that melts at 660 degrees C to evaporate off of the surface. If we're using another form of CVD, like LPCVD or low-pressure chemical vapor deposition, that temperature is still typically rather high above the melting point of aluminum. So when we talk about deposited oxides, PECVD is a low temperature process when compared to other CVD techniques, and certainly when compared to furnace oxidation. So the resulting oxide produced in a CVD technique can still have some of the respectable qualities that a wet grown oxide might have. In order to improve the quality of the oxide that's deposited through a PECVD application, you can alter the oxygen-containing gas. So you could react silane with something like nitrous oxide or carbon dioxide to improve the quality of that oxide material. So lastly, we're going to talk about why you might want to change the oxide material to meet different applications through the modification of dielectric constant. So on this screen, you're going to see the equation for capacitance, and K is the dielectric constant, the A is the area of the device, and the small d is the distance between features. So as the device dimensions decrease, or as we lower this small d, the capacitance will tend to increase inside these devices. So if we want the electrical properties of the device to scale appropriately with the decrease in feature dimensions, we can change this K value to, we can decrease this K value in order to accommodate the electrical property change as the device sizes change. And being able to control these variables through material selection allows for control over the signal time of electric devices as well. So as metal features get smaller and closer together, the dielectric constant of the material needs to be decreased so that the same insulating properties are met as the device components shrink. And here is a list of some materials that have a low K or a low dielectric constant that can be used instead of silicon dioxide as device dimensions decrease. So we say that these are low K materials because we typically use silicon dioxide's dielectric constant as a standard. So the K for silicon dioxide is 3.9. On the other hand, there are some reasons that we might want to have a high K material. And as features tend to shrink, it can be more difficult to maintain uniformity across those surfaces. And when creating gates on electric devices, optimal performance rests in being able to control the uniformity of that material. And it's much easier to achieve uniformity if you can increase the thickness of that material. So Gate materials tend to require a thicker material so that the uniformity can be maintained. But increasing the gate thickness means that the material needs to have a higher K value. So in some aspects, we need to decrease the K value of the dielectric in order to maintain capacitance. In other regards, we need to increase the K value of a material in order to achieve other electrical properties. So here's a list of some high K dielectric materials. And again, to keep this in perspective, the K for silicon dioxide is 3.9. So this will conclude the discussion on dielectric materials and oxidation. Thank you for listening.